Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Keenelly, and as usual, we've got a very interesting guest. And what are we going to be talking about today? We're going to be talking about issues associated with nanotechnology, I think, is the basic area we're going to delve into. Nanotechnology is sort of appearing everywhere. But what are the real impacts of nanomaterials on plants, on people? We don't know that. So who's going to be our guest, Russell?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio from the Connecticut Agricultural Experimental Station, Dr. Jason White. He's the head of the Department of Analytical Chemistry, and he's here to talk about nanomaterials and their effect on plants and so on. Welcome to Science Studio, Jason.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Well, Jason, you were here many years ago, in fact, when you were doing a different type of work. And let's just very quickly recap. How did Jason become a scientist?
Well, going through grade school, I always had an interest in science. That's kind of where my strength was. And as an undergraduate, I actually selected my college because I wanted to be in forestry. So I was looking for a master's degree in forestry. But as I got into classes, I became more interested in environmental science, which kind of led to environmental toxicology as a graduate student and ended up in an analytical chemistry department. So that was kind
forestry,
of the evolution.
Tell us, where did you grow up? Were you looking at trees all the time? Or?
No, actually, I grew up in the suburbs, so maybe I was longing to see trees.
I see. Okay. So there were dreams that you had.
Yeah, yeah. But the interest in science and the environment was kind of always there, which was, you know, kind of interesting because I have a twin brother who, you know, that was always the last thing he was interested in. And we ended up going down different paths.
What path did he go down? That's interesting.
He actually has a PhD in criminal justice, and he's a professor at Arizona State University.
Did you, as an undergraduate, did you do much in the way of sort of research as an undergraduate? I mean, was that something that helped stimulate your career development?
Yeah, it was really, well, as with most undergraduate programs, it was really the last year, the senior year. But I had a couple of good professors who really liked to get their students, undergraduate students, into the lab and see how you actually ask and answer questions. And I kind of caught that bug because, you know, even many, many years later, even as an administrator and a department head, my favorite thing to do is to actually get in the lab and do the research, which happens far less than it should. But
What did you do? What was the project? Do you remember?
The original project, we were actually looking at lead. We were trying to figure out, which I think is something you're familiar with, Keith.
Right.
We were trying to measure just a straightforward concentration of lead in different soils, which is not as easy as it sounds, as you know. So,
and it's amazing that lead still comes with us. I mean, it seems to be that the story of analyzing different materials for lead is never going to stop.
No.
Never going to stop.
No.
And even though we don't use very much anymore, at least not in gasoline.
Well, you know, it was interesting. I was listening to a talk about ancient Egyptian cosmetics that the women were using. And there were lead minerals. They were putting lead minerals all over their face.
Uh-huh.
Maybe that's why they look like mummies after a while.
And I don't know what their life expectancy was. Anyway, so now you're in this Connecticut agency.
Right.
Tell us exactly, first of all, what is the agency and what is it responsible for? Well, and then what are you really actually interested in doing?
Right. It's the Agricultural Experiment Station. And actually, every state in the nation has an Agricultural Experiment Station. Connecticut happened to be the first. In 1875, a Yale chemistry professor petitioned the Connecticut State Legislature to establish the first Agricultural Experiment Station. It was a system, Samuel Johnson is his name. He saw it in Germany, and he really thought the U.S. should have it. So every state has one, but Connecticut is kind of odd in that we're the only one that is still an independent state agency. All other agricultural experiment stations are associated with universities. But the original law that was written in Connecticut said that we had to be an independent state agency. Our job is actually to provide scientific advice to the governor, scientific council. So we couldn't be gobbled up by a university.
Hang on. So you give scientific advice not necessarily associated with agricultural issues.
Right. The original mandate of the station, and it was really only two guys that began, and it was initially feed and fertilizer analysis for adulteration because of the agriculture in the state. But right now, you know, our institution, we have about 85 people working there, and agriculture is probably one of the smaller programs at this point. My department, we do a lot of food safety work. We do a lot of public health with eastern equine encephalitis, West Nile virus, things like that.
Well, we know that Connecticut is a big tobacco state. What are you saying about that these days?
There still are a fair number of tobacco farms in the northern half of the state.
For cigars, really, specialty.
Right. Right. We actually have two laboratory facilities, and the second laboratory facility is up in Windsor, Connecticut, which is in the northern part of the state. And for decades, it was actually referred to – we call it now the Valley Laboratory, but for decades it was referred to as the Tobacco Research Station. And we still have a couple of scientists up there who are doing work with tobacco growers, but all of the leaves, most of them are actually getting sent to Europe right now. They're being imported, exported from here, imported over
there. Make very high expense cigars out of them.
I believe so.
That's interesting because, you know, this is Russell's forte. This is why he's a good co-host, because he knows all this esoteric information. I always thought tobacco was down in the South, Virginia and places like that. So I've learned something on the program. So there still is a thriving tobacco industry.
Yeah, and we're actually – my laboratory is doing some work with them because the sending of the tobacco leaves over to Europe is relatively new, and the EU obviously has – restrictions on pesticide residues in tobacco leaves, which is a little ironic, but they do. So they won't import the leaves without some data on pesticide residue contamination.
Do they rely on your data, or do they repeat it over there to make sure?
I would imagine they repeat it, but at least to get it over there, we're doing some simple screening. We're actually doing it as a research project because they're trying to come up with techniques to reduce pesticide use. So varying timing, using multiple products. So it's not just a regulatory program. It's actually research-based.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting, too. And I don't remember the name, but there's a real upscale cigar manufacturer in Europe. And so they're taking tobacco leaves from Connecticut, making a special cigar, and from Havana.
And blending them.
Well, maybe they blend them, maybe they don't, but they have selections.
And then selling them back to the U.S. embargoing the part of the – it's like in Japan when they were looking at the rice. You know, there was some international trade agreement that they had to have so much rice that they purchased from, let's say, Louisiana or the U.S., all right? But then the Japanese people didn't like the American style of rice. But how do you get around that? Well, so when you buy a package of rice – there's two parts to it. There's the big chunk, and then there's little 10% added on in a separate package so the Japanese can simply throw that part of it away.
It was also with sake.
So the same idea with cigars.
Sake. You know, right? if your sake was made from rice from California, dump it out. So
well, give it away
secrets.
As a gift at least. Yeah. So tell us then, I mean, this is one of the roles which the Agricultural Experimental Station has, but this nanotechnology business, let's talk about that a little bit.
Right.
Just give the audience a little brief history, as you see it, of the growth of nanotechnology and the implications it has for society that you are particularly interested in.
Right. There's actually been a fair amount of interest in nanotechnology, probably for a couple of decades. But in the U.S., at least, funding from the federal government really started in 2000 when President Clinton issued the National Nanotechnology Initiative, which basically was a mandate that I think it was 8 or 12 originally federal agencies, but now it's basically all of them. Federal agencies that fund research in general are mandated to fund a certain amount of nanotechnology grants. So that was really kind of the start of kickstarting this type of research. So what's happened in the last 12 years is obviously a tremendous amount of research and development for using nanotechnology for any of a variety of things, everything from cosmetics to sunscreens to medical devices, water treatment. Disease research is being revolutionized right now by nanotechnology. But what has happened is that almost all of that research dollars has been towards research and development. And there was always a little tiny fraction of the funding pie that was what the acronym was EHS, Environmental Health and Safety, basically the implications of nanotechnology. And that's kind of where my interest has been because I think, you know, we've kind of gone full bore down this road of nanotechnology and some of the uses are tremendous. Disease research, you know, things like that, water treatment. But then you have, you know, nanoparticles being added to cosmetics, to fertilizers, to pesticides, to pacifiers so that mold doesn't grow on the pacifier. So, you know, some of these uses are starting to raise the eyebrows of some people. And that's the federal government is kind of agreeing with this because the amount of funding for environmental health and safety has been increasing the last few years.
So each of the agencies that has to have a focus on nanotechnology also has to have a smaller focus on the environmental health and safety issues.
Originally, I think it was probably 5% or less for an individual agency. And obviously, the amount individual agencies spend right. varies. If you got NIH, it's a tremendous dollar value. If you got USDA, it's much smaller. But the percentages are supposed to be the same. They have to spend a certain amount on environmental health and safety, and that certain amount is increasing.
So let's then take some specifics that come through your particular facility. So, I mean, where are you seeing important aspects of nanotechnology having potentially harmful effect on health and safety, et cetera?
Right. Well, again, I work in an agricultural experiment station, so our interest is really in food and food safety. And my laboratory, about 75% of what we do is actually regulatory work with the state food and environmental agencies, but also with the FDA and the EPA. So we interact a lot with regulators, and then 25% of the time is on the research. So this is an instance where, you know, some regulatory questions that arose. In other words, are nanoparticles safe, really? Are they being used the way we should be using them?
Are you finding any in the environment that you worry about?
Well, that's an interesting issue, because the one gaping hole in this whole area of what I call nanotoxicology is the difficulty in detecting nanomaterials.
They're
really,
tiny.
Really small, and they're constantly changing. And having a technique to detect them consistently and reliably is extremely difficult. There are techniques like ICP, where you can detect total amounts of elements, or gas and liquid chromatography, where you can see, you know, kind of the blanket approach of what's there. But, you know, when you look at silver can be an ion, it can be a bulk particle, and it can be a nanoparticle. And being able to differentiate those three pieces is exceptionally difficult.
What about atomic force microscopy? We do a lot of nano work here, and that's one of the things that we use frequently for looking at sizes like that.
Yeah, microscopy is really good. AFM, atomic force microscopy, electron microscopy really works. But they really work from kind of a narrow view. You're looking at a very small portion of the sample. When I talk to people who work for FDA, the one person I was talking to, he said he wants to be able to walk into a grocery store, pull off a can of corn off the shelf, and 10 minutes later he wants to know if there are nanoparticles in it, because there's nanoparticles in the lining of that can, silver or copper, to prevent bacterial growth. How are you going to take an entire can of corn or an entire lot of corn cans and in 20 or 30 minutes know if there's nanoparticles in there? You could take one kernel out of one can and divide it up into tiny little sections and see. And that's an extremely interesting research question, but that's not what the regulators want to know. They want to know, you know, is it in there or isn't it in there? And that's where the gap is, because we have these very powerful techniques, but we're trying to scale them up to what the regulatory
community is. Yeah, but is there any evidence that people are getting sick from this?
No, none. Well, the flip side of the coin is nobody's really looked yet either. So. Yeah.
Do people that use nanotechnology have to register somehow with a Department of Nanotechnology somewhere in the government to say, hey, we are now introducing nanoparticles into our product, or do they have to register the fact they're using these materials?
In the United States, no. Basically, the regulatory framework that has existed for 10 or 15 years has been that basically size doesn't matter. If you're making a new product, or you're synthesizing a new formulation of a pesticide, for example, and you want to put carbon nanotubes in there or copper oxide nanoparticles, you don't need to alert anybody to that.
Okay. What about Europe, for example?
Europe right now, Europe is going down the road that they went with genetically modified foods, where labeling was required. Probably within 6 months in the EU, there's going to be a law passed that's saying if a product has nanotechnology as part of its components, or nanotechnology was used in the synthesis, it's going to be on the label.
And therefore, you assume that in 5 or 10 years, that will apply in North America too?
I don't think so. I mean,
you don't think so?
We still are not labeling genetically modified foods. That was just defeated in California. And federally, there's no motivation to label those products at all.
Yeah, but there's a big difference. I mean, there's no evidence or no thought that genetically modified food is bad for you.
Right.
But there is some evidence, perhaps, that nanomaterials will not be necessarily good for you. We'll be back in one moment. You're listening to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Jason White from the Connecticut Agricultural Experimental Station. We'll be back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel. It's astounding that the complex human body starts from a single cell, the fertilized egg. Once fertilized, the single cell rapidly divides to form a handful of cells that will become all the cell types needed to create a new human being. For years, scientists assume once these embryonic stem cells differentiate to become specialized cells such as liver or skin cells, they can't go backwards into an immature state. But the two winners of the 2012 Nobel in Physiology or Medicine disproved that assumption and revolutionized our understanding of human development. Not only did they show that inside each of our mature specialized cells is the genetic information for the body's other cells, mature cells can also revert to an embryonic-like state. One of the winners, John B. Gurdon, actually proved this idea 50 years ago, but was met with much skepticism. He replaced the nucleus of a frog egg cell with the nucleus of the frog's mature intestinal cell. If the mature cell nucleus still carried the genes for development, once fertilized, the egg would become a tadpole, and it did. In 2006, Shinya Yamanaka, the other Nobel winner, furthered Gurdon's work by finally showing mature cells can be programmed to de-differentiate into immature stem cells. He identified four genes in mouse embryos that, when introduced into mature skin cells, reactivated the genes responsible for early development. Yamanaka's method is used in labs worldwide, and its implications are that one day people's own cells can be regrown into healthy cells to treat their own disease. We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Jason C. White from the Connecticut Agricultural Experimental Station. And we're talking about nanotechnology and investigating, do nanomaterials have any deleterious effect on crops in your particular case? Talk about then specifically some experiments that you do, some research that you do as opposed to the regulatory analysis.
Right. It's actually an interesting story of how I got into what I call nanotoxicology. It's a perfect example of serendipity, which is how a lot of interesting things happen in science. In 2009, I had no interest at all in nanotechnology or nanotoxicology, but I had a buddy at a local university who had a student who was having some problems. They were trying to test the toxicity of carbon nanotubes on bacteria. He had 6 months left in his program, and he couldn't get the bacteria to grow. They were physicists, so they probably shouldn't have been trying to grow bacteria. But they knew I grew plants, and they knew I did phytoremediation research, which is what we talked about a couple of years ago. So they wanted to know if we could switch and if they could switch and test the toxicity of nanomaterials to plants. I didn't know anything about nanomaterials at the time, but I knew a lot about plants. So I said, sure, send the kid over. And in 3 months, he ran the experiments and got some really interesting data. The interesting part being, you know, as I said originally, size isn't supposed to matter from a regulatory standpoint. So if you expose a plant to silver, for example, that plant should respond the same way to silver regardless of whether it's a nanoparticle or not. Well, this student's data actually showed the complete opposite effect, that the smaller particles tended to be more toxic and they were accumulated to a greater extent. So I took that interesting finding and I went into the literature because, again, I didn't really know anything about this and nobody had ever shown that before. So,
but hang on a minute. The standard was then some larger size powder, for
right,
example.
Right, just the regular.
Not solution silver.
Right, exactly.
Okay, gotcha.
So what size are these particles we're talking about? Because the physicists know that as you make the particle smaller, it's no longer silver. It gets constrained and some becomes different properties.
Right. Right now, the definition that everybody includes regulatory agencies and the federal government is using is anything smaller than 100 nanometers is considered to be a nanoparticle. So if the average particle size, and there are a variety of ways you do that by electron microscopy or dynamic light scattering, if the average particle size is less than 100 nanometers, we call it a nanoparticle. It's a completely arbitrary definition. In fact, we've shown in my laboratory differences between 5 nanometers behaving different than 20 nanometers. So, but you need somewhere to start from a textbook definition.
And if it's less than 100, presumably it's not easy to say I want to do nanotechnology and I want to have 10 nanometer materials. To go out there and make 10 nanometer materials in bulk, very difficult.
Yeah, it is very difficult.
I mean, you just don't. You always get a Gaussian distribution of sizes.
Right, and most of the nanoparticles that you can buy, you can go to any chemistry vendor, Fisher, Aldrich, and you can buy, you know, silver nanoparticles, for example. I keep coming back to silver because that's the one that's used most in agriculture. And what you buy, it will say less than 100 nanometers or less than 60 nanometers. But when you take that and you actually look at it in your laboratory, you're exactly right. It's the bell-shaped curve, and you've got stuff down to 10 and you've got stuff up to 150. But what you see is the average is whatever, you know, less than 60 or something like that.
So this was silver.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. I was reading the other day that the ancient Greeks and Romans were using silver colloids to purify water.
Right, and silver colloids are actually silver in nanoparticle form.
Yeah.
Yeah, silver is actually one with a very interesting history because it's people have been using the nanoparticle form for hundreds of years. I mean, and in some cases, you know, to a comic extent. And you remember the blue man who was on TV?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He was blue because of overexposure to silver
and
the pigmentation change.
Oh, that's a part of culture I missed altogether. That sounds interesting. So mostly the silver, as you were talking about, is used as antibiotic properties. Is that the,
right,
the real reason?
Right, it's being used for its antimicrobial properties. And, I mean, the mechanisms haven't been completely worked out, but if you have a smaller particle, you have greater surface area and you're going to get greater release of silver ions. And
right.
Generally speaking, most people think that it's the silver ions that are antimicrobial. So that one might be fairly straightforward. But so now you can buy sweat socks, you know, athletic socks that have silver nanoparticles in them to kill the bacteria that cause the smell. You can buy Band-Aids from Johnson & Johnson that are, they say, antimicrobial Band-Aids. They're antimicrobial because within the cotton weave there are silver nanoparticles.
So this is the big industry developing.
Yeah, right now the estimate is it's going to be a $3 trillion industry by 2020.
okay.
And in 2005, it was a $3 billion industry. So the growth has just been incredible.
So is there an opportunity for investment? Who makes silver nanoparticles?
I would imagine so. I'm on the other end, but I think – you know, the growth and development that has been going on is going to continue to an even greater extent.
Let's get down to it then, because I've heard lots of talks on nanoparticles, right? And I've never quite understood the following feature, that you put nanoparticles into the soil and you grow a plant, and this is up your alley, and then you look into the plant and you see nanoparticles, right? I've always assumed, without having any evidence for it, that as you said, that the nanoparticles go into solution, you get the ions move through, and then they reaccumulate. Is that more or less correct, or am I just way off?
To answer the question, truthfully, we don't know yet. I actually think you're probably right, but nobody's really shown that yet. You know, and it's very difficult to explain this to a regulator, but the chemical reaction between nanoparticle ion and then an aggregation to a nanoparticle, and then nanoparticles aggregate to become not nano anymore. That's a completely dynamic system in solution, in water. And then you throw a plant in there or you throw soil in there and it becomes incredibly complex.
Well, this is very much like phytoremediation, which, you know, I've worked on most of my career for that. Well, another question would be, what's wrong with it? Why isn't it being used more? But the plant takes up the silver and puts it in vacuole somewhere, and you can measure the silver there. Well, you ought to be able to tell the crystallite size or whatever it is. I mean, does it come out as a compound or silver metal when it's collected in the plant?
You can find it as the metal. I mean, you can find it in the nanoparticle and in some cases non-nanoparticle form. And again, the nanoparticle definition is just telling you particle size. So if you see a chunk of black stuff in a vacuole and you do electron microscopy and you hit it with the energy dispersive X-ray spectroscopy, which is what tells you what element it is, and it tells you it's silver, then you measure the diameter, and if it's less than 100, you say it's a silver nanoparticle. If it's more than 100, you say it's a silver aggregate. I mean, a lot of this is semantics.
But if you happen to live over a silver mine, the idea is to plant these plants, and then you can collect the silver without mining it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's a whole area of phytoremediation called phytomining.
Yeah.
And there's a company that actually does this with nickel now, that they use plants to mine nickel out of.
Where is that?
Where is it exactly? What's the name of the company?
I'm drawing a blank on the name of the company, but it was originally from a professor at the University of Maryland who then went to Georgia. You know, and there's a company that does arsenic phytoremediation.
Yeah.
So there are some companies doing this for a profit.
Tell us what you've really learned. I mean, okay, you've got the research group. You've got the focus. What is it that you have sort of begun to unravel that has been surprising and novel for the rest of us?
the question that I'm trying to answer is a very simple one. And, again, we work a lot with the regulatory community. And the regulatory community is a little worried right now because there are over 1,300 commercially available products that have nanomaterials on them. There's probably a lot more, but those are the ones that are known. So, these materials are in products. They're in sunscreens. They're in food packaging. They're in pesticides and fertilizers and electronics. And the regulatory assumption for 10 years has been that size doesn't matter. Well, now we're starting to get some data that says, well, wait a minute, maybe it does. Maybe the toxicity is different. So the regulatory community is starting to get a little bit worried that, the horse has already left the barn and they're shutting the door.
But you say there's no evidence that anybody's getting ill.
Right. But that doesn't mean there's no evidence that the particles
aren't
behaving differently.
However, these bad entities called corporations are making money, so they're probably doing something to us, huh?
Well, there's always a conspiracy theory, which is why maybe I think, my approach is a good one, which is you have a regulatory law that you're – a regulatory framework that you're existing in, and you're making an assumption. Is that assumption a good one or a bad one? I still think it's an open question because if we show that silver nanoparticles are five times more toxic than regular silver and they're toxic by the same mechanism, then we have nothing to worry about. Because when EPA does a risk assessment and sets a regulatory limit for something, they find out what level's toxic, and then they divide it by 10. Sometimes they divide it by 100. These are called safety factors. So if it's five times more toxic, the nanoparticle is, but you've got a 100-fold safety factor in there, we've got nothing to worry about. Where I think we might have a problem is if because the particle is small, it actually has a different mechanism of toxicity. It gets into the cell by a different way, interacts with the membrane or the DNA or something differently. Then you got a different issue. You basically have something you need to regulate differently. And, that's an open question at this point. And that's really the question that I'm trying to answer.
Going back to that then, can you come up with a sort of an equivalency point of view that you've got nanoparticles at a certain concentration and a certain size and that would be equivalent to a silver cation solution of such and such a concentration?
Yeah, I think that's possible. I think that's something people who model things could probably model that.
And that would be much clearer to say it was a good idea or a bad idea.
Right.
Because you can do solutions of metal ions and look at bacteria and cells, and then you've got a whole different game.
Exactly.
So that's the correlation that one would like to see in the end.
I think that's ultimately where we could end up. I mean, it's going to take a tremendous amount of data to get there.
Yeah. But since all the agencies have got to do research on environmental health and safety of nanoparticles.
Right, and since they're spending more money on it now,
right,
we could get there.
Thank God for the protective agencies we have. Hey, it's been great fun having you here again, and look forward to coming back many times.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks to Jason White from the Connecticut Agricultural Experimental Station, and thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
So come back next week. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.